Tell me about yourself.
Well, let's see, I'm a history professor at Georgia Tech, and I've been working on this study of race relations in Atlanta for about 2 or 3 years now. Originally from New York, been here about 15 years.
Oh, that's good. Jane? Professor Bear brought up those things Evan left. Jane Abram. What's your first name?
Ron
Bear.
Ron.
He brought up the things that Evan left downstairs.
Thank you.
Okay.
Well, I thought I'd start by asking how effective your organization was in changing segregationist policies. This would be the Greater Atlanta Council of Relations. Let's see, was the government willing to, was the city government willing to listen to what you had to say?
No, I don't think they were. That was why my title was the way I did.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody knew, you know, what was going on. Everybody knew what had to happen sooner or later.
Mm-hmm.
And there were the Southern Regional Council, of which the Atlanta Council was a sort of under that umbrella, but had far more prestige. It had, the Southern Regional Council had among its membership people like Ralph McGill,
mm-hmm.
and Bruce Clement, and the power structure in Atlanta didn't really pay much attention to group organizations or citizens, you know. People said, let's do this because it's right. And to that extent, that's an interesting question. I never wondered about that before. I think we were instrumental in providing information and bothering people. You know, they never did anything because we said do it.
I was just wondering whether Ivan Allen or somebody. Was Mayor Allen receptive at all to?
Well, actually, the person, Sam Marcel, was the mayor,
mm-hmm.
who had been the most active in he was the one who had ever taken any notice of the organization. People like Ivan Allen dealt with the power structure, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, they were all up here. Sam Marcel he wasn't a member of the council, but he would come to meetings, and he would do things like, when Ralph Bunch came to Atlanta, and Sam was willing to introduce him and came and went to press each of his office as vice mayor. And then when he was elected mayor, he did, he was largely instrumental in passing the ordinance which established the Community Relations Commission.
I have a quote from Martin Luther King in December of 1963, and I was curious what you think about it. He said, in the absence of legal, political, economic, and moral pressure, not even a city as enlightened as Atlanta is likely to grant the Negro his constitutional rights. Number one, how enlightened was Atlanta at this time?
Atlanta, it's strange looking back. I started to say we all knew what was happening. We didn't really all know what was happening. For instance, I never knew until I was working kind of day-to-day in the Council on Human Relations that the funeral services were segregated. That the Grady Hospital, when you call Grady to report an emergency, they want to know the race of the victim because they didn't have very many ambulances to create, and so they had to call the funeral homes to send the ambulances. And the funeral homes were segregated, therefore they had to know if it was man, black, or white.
Which meant that some people were denied immediate service.
Yes. Oh, yes.
It's
And things like the hospitals, you see. I had never had any occasion to wonder what kind of hospital services blacks had in Atlanta in the 60s. And I don't know what provoked this. Well, just the fact that when you were in a situation when you met black people and professional people, and you met certain meetings, and you became individual friends with them, you just, from casual conversation, you learned things. Like the fact that the only private hospital in Atlanta, which the only paying hospital which a black person could go to for service, was what they called Hughes Bowman Division. And I remember saying to a woman who taught at Morris Brown College, "What do you do when you get sick?" And it was a very serious question. And she laughed. She said, "Well, we just make a point always to get sick either in Baltimore or Rochester."
So there really wasn't much thought among the white community about the high mortality rate among blacks.
Well, we didn't know it. We didn't. Your association with the black community was mostly in terms of servants. The blacks were part of the white world, but in that sense. But I remember riding in a car with the wife of a black doctor, the black wife of a black doctor, not either very black and white, down Hunter Street along Michigan Drive. And I commented on the holes in the road. And she said, "It's terrible. Why don't y'all get something out of that?" And she said, "Well, I thought all the roads in the world were like this, all the streets like this." And we stopped the car, her Cadillac, her riding in, and we looked at each other. And I said, "I had never, this is the first time I had ever ridden west of Marietta Street."
So,
and she said, "Well, she'd never been east of Boulevard."
So there really was two separate cities.
It was two separate cities. It really was.
I know there were a lot of reports going through the years, Urban League reports,
yeah,
about conditions of grainy,
yes,
schools,
yes,
and with the white community,
yes,
aware of that at all?
Well, we were aware of the schools because the Supreme Court decision brought that to our attention rather forcibly. But the things like hospitals, banks, you know, credit cards, housing, it was something that, unless it impinged on your own personal life, it was, you were so accustomed to it, you know, that it's one of those things that you never thought of. The only black women I knew were the few maids I had, and I didn't know any whites of their economic and social. So I didn't have any comparison. To me, the housing where she lived and the problem she had with child care represented her economic class, not that she was black.
Did you have much contact with the college-educated, upper-middle-class blacks at all?
None. The Unitarian Church, and we had Whitney Young was a member of the church, and a few of them, a lawyer, and some, you know, successful businessmen. But through the Unitarian Church, I know my daughter, one of my children, got to be friends with a girl her own age. And she went and spent a day at school with this black girl. Went to Washington High. And she was so... She wanted to go to Washington, she wanted to transfer immediately because they wore high heels to school. And we were both struck with the fact that she could go and visit at this black girl's school. And she was welcomed by everybody. And in fact, she was quite a celebrity. Everybody made a big thing over her. But there was no inviting the black girl to come to the hill.
That would cause a some form of protest at that.
Oh, well, we didn't even think of it. I mean, nobody would just be on the, you know, within pure fans.
So it was really a divine city.
It was a divine city. And it was everywhere in the city.
How about the tradition of compromise and communication between the black and white communities that Atlanta was so heralded as being the forefront of the city too busy to hate? How true is that? Was there some communication on this?
Oh, well, I think the people in charge of the city had to know what was happening. And this is the thing that I used to wonder about after it was all over, really. Why? You know, there weren't any, if there were any city ordinances against segregation of the restaurants, for example, there were lots of other ordinances that nobody paid any attention to. And you just wondered sometimes, why didn't Ivan Allen just call up Dr. Mays, who was president of the house, and say, let's go to lunch and Rich's. That's finally what happened. You know, that's what happened. Fine. After all the sit-ins and everything, they made an arrangement that on a certain day, some well-dressed blacks, well-behaved, would come to Rich's Tea Room for lunch. But they wouldn't come until 2:00. And I was one of the whites who went along to kind of monitor what happened. You know, we gathered around at about 2:00 in the waiting area, and there were a couple of reporters there, and they said, oh, something's going on, you know. So we were all trying to be very casual. And then, you know, the elevator opened, and here was Q.B. Williams, and he was the first black alderman, and he got off with his family. And I joined them, and we went and sat down and ordered lunch. And everybody asked, well, it just happened every day. I mean, you know, Rich's. And it was, well, we would have, you know, we'd be glad to have him come any time.
This was 64
I think this was probably before the law passed. I'm saying we could have done it any time we wanted to.
Without the student person?
Yes. Yes.
So why was Alan not willing to put the gamble on the thing?
I don't know. I don't know. I never knew him that well.
Yeah.
Ralph McGill, you know, is honored and rightly so as Ralph has been while he was alive and since his death. He would write editorials that got him hate mail from some of the whites. But if Ralph McGill had taken Dr. Mays to lunch, you know, nobody was going to, Richards was not going to withdraw his ads from the paper. And it's this thing of what, you know, the whole thing came back to me last summer. I had an opportunity to travel from in Africa, right down to New York to Cape Town. And you know, Helen Sussman, the woman who has been a member of the South African Forum for so long. Well, in the 60s, she was in Atlanta on the State Department and stayed at my house for a week. And so we saw for a minute when we were in Cape Town. But she, you know, she has this technique now. She makes all these speeches and poems, and they have to put it in the record, and then it becomes, and then get by the censor. But she was reporting on the differences between the services available to whites and blacks in the Soweto area. And she was talking about the postal service, that there were like 5 workers for 10,000 blacks and 100 workers for 1,000 whites, you know, that kind of thing. And Jane and I were there together, and I said to her, I feel as if I'm back in the Georgia legislature 20 years ago, sitting in the balcony, listening to these same kind of statistics and the same explanations.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wanted to get up and say, just do it. just hold your breath and jump in and do it. And you'll find that the world doesn't stop.
I guess that's what has to happen with that.
Yeah.
How about the role of the Community Relations Commission? You were the first executive director of that. How effective was that in bringing about change with NDY Wells?
Well, the Community Relations Commission, really, the City Council would just as soon not had it. And Allen would just as soon not had it. They did not look upon it as there to, as something that they could use. Right? They never referred things to us, you see. They really, because they thought it would stir things up. What I think the purpose of the Community Relations Commission did serve was to hold these, as we call them, public hearings in the neighborhoods. And some of those things just couldn't be ignored, you know.
But the mayor was afraid of you going too fast, stirring things up on the race.
Well, he just ignored us. He didn't really made no decision on the group at all. And it's funny. I was hired with a one-year contract. And I was certainly not the choice. And I mainly was hired because of the black members of the Council on Human Relations and the NAACP and like that wanted me there because they said that they could trust me. And it was kind of funny, they could trust me. But I didn't have very much to trust him with, you know, because I know Dan Sweat was this. And he took care of everything that wasn't taken care of. But during the course of that year, I forgot when this was in the book or not, but there was a young black man who was a professor at ITC, then theological thing, and he wanted to take his little girl to the Wren's Nest. And of course, that was strictly, I'm not sacred, just not for blacks at all. I said, he asked if I would go with him, and I said yes. And I didn't ask anybody if I could, because I thought, you know, that was sort of part of my job. And someone, I did not call, but I think he called one of the television stations. Anyway, there was a television camera when he got there, and he opened the door, and this frightened woman, you know, said, Yes, and we said, well, this little girl would like to come in and see the forensic exhibits. And she said, oh, I'm sorry, we can't let you in. Can't do that. And she, and we didn't ask her why. She just said, well, she couldn't let us in. And so then we said, well, could we sit on the porch and swing? And she said, oh, yes. And no, she couldn't run us off. You know. Well, that was in the television news. And it turned out that the wife of Milton Ferris, who was chair of the Finance Committee of Council, was very active in that. And nobody ever reprimanded him for it. But when the time came, when the first year was up and when my contract was due, you know, not, it was, I was told that it would not. Yes, and that was really sort of the end of the commission. It never really got going. But what was so funny is that later, that now the Wren's Nest is included in the city's cultural program and all that. So, you know, the sad thing is that everything that we objected to and everything that took such a great toll on everybody of things which have come about now, and everybody just looks fine and says, you know, what in the world could anybody have objected?
Well, historically, that's usually what happens. It takes time for people to do it. But you don't think it was, the CRC was effective in, let's say, changing city hiring practices, for example, or police brutality?
Well, I think we were effective in in communication, in providing an area of communication. I think that what we did, the hearings that we had, so-called hearings, which were just public forums, and the fact that we had that many more blacks and whites working together, the press covered the things that we did. And I think that that was our biggest contribution, that the majority of the middle class white people going along, you know, going from Druid Hills or Tucker or Sandy Springs that way into town every day, attending to the job and the family, it didn't involve them one another. And in those cases where some of them were asked to sign petitions or to change policies in positions, I know the man who was administrator of Eggleston Hospital was a very good friend of mine, and it upset him that they didn't take the black children. But he said, if I push for it, I'll lose my job. And he probably would have. So, and you had to respect that, you know. But the average person wasn't in any danger of losing their job, and they just didn't know, you know.
Why was the CRC eliminated later on? I think it was eliminated at the Young's administration.
Well, it should have been a long time ago, because it really, after that first year, when they made such a to-do, when the commission voted not to renew my contract, and they never would say why, and I figured that it's because Mr. Farris said if you want any money from the city, you know, you get rid of that woman who went and took that little girl to Ramses and embarrassed my wife. But they appointed a white man named, what's his name, Welch, Matt Welch. But the black members of the commission and the black community would not accept him. Mm-hmm. And so, they did anything.
But Samuel Williams took over a little later on, if you remember.
Oh, Samuel. Well, he was not the paid executive.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, he was the chairman.
Sure.
Yeah. And he did a strange talk about faith. There was a white man named Irving Taylor who was the chairman of the commission.
Right.
And then it turned out that he didn't live in the city limits. And so he resigned. And Sam Williams, who had been the vice chairman, they became chairman. And Sam, as chairman, never had to vote on my reappointment, but we had some discussion about it, and I always figured that Sam was told by Mr. Ferris or somebody that, you know, if you're going to be in with a power structure, you've got to act like a power structure. And so, and then he died not too long after.
Yeah. So do you think the thrust of all this was that the CRC was designed to calm the black community, to give them the impression that somebody was listening, but not to really bring about
major
changes?
It was established in response to a lot of pressure from the black community and the Council on Human Relations. We had really put that as sort of our goal, because we felt that it was time for the city to have something official,
mm-hmm.
and something funded, and something accountable, you know, that could say we're doing this in the name of the city, and that was long overdue in Atlanta. And it was such a reasonable argument that you couldn't really be opposed to it. So I think the people in City Hall just went along with it, just, you know, wasn't worth fighting.
Was Michelle more receptive?
Michelle, but yes, he was. And he called on the commission a time or two to hold certain hearings and do this and that. But and I don't think Sam Michelle has gotten the recognition that he deserves in the city's progress in racial relations. personally, I think he, well, I started saying he really could, because he could have invited Dr. Basco lunch too. But at least he didn't go with Dr. Bunch, and he made appearances at places where it was important, you know, for him to be. But I don't know. I don't know how. You know, you wonder. So we all knew that certain things were going to happen, but it was that who was going to be the first one, you know?
Everybody waited for somebody else.
Yeah. So then we were glad to have the wall, but you had to do it.
I was curious also about the school desegregation situation. I know you were talking about that.
Mm-hmm.
And I was curious, I mean, here we went from integration, or at least minor integration, to
mm-hmm.
resegregation in about 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
Could the school board, superintendent lesson, could they have done it any better? Could it have moved faster? Could the white flag have been prevented? Do you see any differences in policies that, you know, that could have been worked out, but that would have prevented resegregation by rights and so forth?
No, I don't think so. I don't think it made all that much difference. At the time, and of course, I think a lot, that we were lots more aware of the school situation and everything else as a community. And I think there was much more recognition that this was inevitable and was going to happen, and the sooner the better. We could all get on with it. There was this, you know, this myth that the schools down if that happened. But, and it seems to me that we could have done it with a little less to do than, you know, we had those 9 students and they took 2 years to get the, I mean, everything at snail's pace.
Bottom of the upper grades.
Yes, yes. And the students who wanted to transfer had to go down to the city hall to fill out the forms.
So it was difficult under freedom of choice for black people.
Oh, very, very intimidating.
Yeah.
And that, I think, they could have done better.
Yeah.
And that was one thing in Dick's account from Human Rights, I think, was very helpful and effective. When we first read the regulations and then set up the plan that, you know, by a certain date, the student would have to go to the Board of Education, the superintendent's office, and all this stuff. So we had white volunteers who would drive the children to get the forms and stay with them and help fill them out. And then we were able to get white families close to each of these 4 schools to act as sort of a sponsor or safe house, you know.
Yeah,
they did, yes. And it was not all that easy to find. We did do it, but in some cases they were not in the school neighborhood, but they were close enough so that they could have, you know, could have gone over. It was a sad little story, but I think it sort of illustrates the whole situation. In a very sincere effort to try to prepare these black students for their new schools and to prepare the schools for them, Dr. Redson and Dr. Stevens, who was the deputy superintendent, arranged to take the transfer students, as they were called, capital T, capital S, to visit their new school and meet their teachers. And I don't know, did I write about this, about whether they should call the teachers ma'am and sir?
I don't know.
Well,
these are the original 9 students.
Yes,
yeah.
Right. We had they had the day, this was a couple of those schools to start, and they took these children to the school. And then we had a meeting, the Council on Human Rights sponsored a meeting at Quaker House. And most of them were Quakers in the interior, and of course, and other people and things like that. And Dr. Stevens gave a report on what had happened that day and what he thought the trouble spots might be and how the students were received and all that. And he was a very sincere, good man. And he said he thought things went pretty well. And then you could tell there was something bothering him. He was very much embarrassed by something, but he felt he had to say it. And so he said to this interracial audience, the only problem that he saw, and a very real problem, was that the black students did not say ma'am and sir to the teachers. And the white students do, and the white teachers expect to be called ma'am and sir. And so one of the Sam Williams, I remember, was committed. And he said, well, we teach our young people not to say ma'am and sir, not to say, because it's terrible. And we teach them to be courteous to everybody, but to have self-respect for men. You don't call any man sir. And Dr. Stevens said, well, you know, I've been a high school principal for 19 years, and if any student in my school did not say sir to anybody, we'd look at them as disrespectful, and, you know, a discipline problem. So, yeah, we were, you know. And you saw all the problems that you would anticipate, and everybody was right, you see. The blacks said, well, why should our children be the ones that have to change? And the whites said, well, why should we have to change? You know, sort of like it's our school, after all. And I think finally Stephen said, it may not be fair, but if you want those students to get along, they have got to say man and sir. Because if they're permitted not to say man and sir, then some of the whites are going to fuss about it. And they're going to not come on to, and then you're going to have a whole discipline problem on your hands. And, you know, it's just one of the costs they have to bear.
So they changed.
Well, I never heard anything more about it, so I guess they did change. But I just thought it was such a, it's so real, you know. And something that you would never have anticipated.
No, never.
Really. And either group could have gone on the rest of their lives doing it their own way, and the other thinking they were doing it on purpose, you know, just to be show off or whatever.
Did you see any effort by Letson or the Board of Education staff to keep whites in transitional schools to hold or to
uphold? Oh, I think, yes. I think that everybody who's had anything to do with education in Atlanta or the state of Georgia, as far as I can tell, anywhere where schools have had any great degree of racial change, had that as a goal and tried to, you know, to use these magnet schools and all that. But I think of what Dr. May said when he, as chairman of the school board, you know, presided over the 7th NAACP suit and was opposed to busing. And Dr. May said that he had never held the opinion that for a black child to learn, he had to be in the room with the white child. And I think that's the philosophy that's finally prevailed in Atlanta. And I really don't see anything more we can do about it. About keeping white.
Because the whites just left the city.
For lots of reasons. But as far as the schools go, I it just seems to me that we have spent so much time since 64 trying to, you know, be worried about the racial composition of the schools rather than what's being taught in the schools.
Well, I think that's changed a little bit. I think there's more emphasis on what's being taught now.
So well, yeah.
I think a lot of black parents would have agreed easily.
Yes.
But you don't see any particular effort to build a school where it could have appeal to both whites and blacks within the same.
Oh, I think the effort has been made to build the schools to have the appeal to both. Yeah.
Not in the 60s.
Well, I think when they first started, when they started those magnet schools, the performing arts schools and things like
late
that.
'60s, I think.
'60s, yeah. Sure. I think that was an effort to have integrated classes and to prove that race was not as important as certain other things. But we found, for whatever reason, either race was more important than we thought it was, or it was, wonderful, good, across those things that became important.
Did you see the time and money spent on resisting integration by the white schools? Did that take away from the quality of the schools in general in Atlanta?
What do you mean, well, we spend money on lawsuits?
Yes. Well, lawsuits, right, lawsuits, time spent on resisting.
I think in that respect, mine has grown from a lot of other places. I don't think we spent much money on lawsuits. I think we knew it was inevitable. And I think Dr. Lexon and the Board of Education, Devin McClatchy, who was chairman of the board, I think, accepted it as inevitable. And once they decided to do it, then they had enough integrity and really enough educational interest to go on and try to make it work.
Yeah. I guess one of the things I'm thinking about is that it's pretty clear how segregation hurt the blacks. I'm curious in what sense it hurt the whites too. Terms of healthcare in the city, schools, housing.
You mean since we desegregated?
Since well before and during the segregation battles. That, in what sense the white community, as well as the black community, lost through a segregated system. Through a school system, for example. Well, that must have hurt.
Yeah.
It must have hurt white care also.
Well, I don't really think. I don't think the whites lost as much as the blacks, obviously. But in many respects, we had two separate school systems. It's like two separate cities. And the black, many of the black schools were very good schools. They had, like Washington High, they taught Russian there. Well, yes, they were. They were all granted. But they were not all bad poor schools, I think obviously whatever has been spent on legal fees and all that, and the wear and tear on people about the desegregation has been costly to everybody. But I think the schools were done in Atlanta with some success and some dignity. And I think a lot of it, of course, was due to the fact that Dr. Mays was chairman of the board.
Well, by that time.
Yeah.
Of course, under Lenson, I think, the schools are probably a little different than that board. I'd say, who was the chairman of the board? The board of the time. Rodney, or who was it? I guess I was just thinking whether whites were in any way aware of how segregation was hurting them. I didn't think about that much of that.
I don't think you could really got through the whites that the whole segregation system was hurting us.
Yeah.
Like hospitals, it sounds awful to say it, but as a matter of fact, it could be odd that it didn't hurt us because we had good hospitals, the schools, the money, if you put the total amount of money, if you combine the school budgets of the black and white schools, a lot of the white schools. schools would have stayed that same.
How about some of that crime? Obviously, there was crime in the black community that was developing out of the poverty.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
Certainly, with
yes.
the sense of that.
Yes.
Well.
No, I don't think so.
No sense that to deal with the crime, you needed to improve the lifestyles of the black community.
Well, you see, we didn't. Crime among blacks is not considered crime.
Yeah.
And that was something.
There was a state in their area.
Well, my husband was with WSB at the Atlanta Journal, and he is, and he used to tell a story about his first, when he first started reporting the journal, he was on the police beat, and it was in the police station, there were three murders reported, and he was all excited, he phoned the city desk and they said, you know, my goodness, where were the people? And they gave him the three addresses, and the man said, you know, it's all niggas. Don't have a bomb, he was phoning to report niggas killing niggas. So now he was conscious of it, you know, but you didn't, it wasn't part of the news, and that was one of the things. When we first started, not first, when Martin Luther King came back to Brown, the Council on Human Relations had a day-long meeting of some sort, and we discussed schools and churches and hospitals, and we had a section on communications, and this impressed me very much. Now, I had not heard it in all the, you know, talking and listening and meetings I've been to. A man named Tillman Coffin, who was a sociologist and ended up president of the Black College in Arkansas, he said that one of the problems of the segregated community is that the blacks and whites don't share. You don't act on a common base of information. Like when you read the daily paper, when a black person read the Atlanta Journal, it didn't apply to him.
Well, there's nothing about blacks.
No, right. And when I didn't even know there was such a paper today in the world until then. And if I read that, you know, it certainly didn't apply to me. So one of the problems has been this lack of a common culture, a common base, you know, acting from the same set of facts. When we said hospitals, meant one thing. When they said hospitals, they meant something else.
And a crime state in the black community,
crime.
It wasn't crime. I guess the police felt the same way. If it was black crime, so what?
Well, there were no black policemen.
Yeah, for 40 years.
Not then. And then we had the big question, you know, we had the black policeman, but they couldn't arrest the white person. And I remember a black professor called Holman, who's in Washington now, I remember him saying, you teach your children that the policeman's a friend. He's somebody to call when you need help. He said, you don't teach our children. So everything was a scenario image. Everything you looked at, everywhere.
But there must have been some sense of bringing black maids and cooks to your homes and realizing that these people are not getting proper health care where they're living. You're opening your home to diseases. Was there any sense of that?
No. I mean, most of the maids had a Grady card. And they got whatever health care they needed. Grady, which has great reputation as a charity hospital. So, in that sense, our association was with the lowest, you know, the lowest group.
That's interesting that there's such a division. Was there any retaliation against people working in the human rights council at all for what they were doing, in terms of losing jobs, threatening calls?
I don't remember anybody losing jobs. They certainly had threatening calls.
Yeah.
And, you know, neighbors wouldn't speak to you at all. My house burned shortly after my husband died in 1959, and he had gotten a lot of criticism because he had he spoke in poetry, and there was a black policeman, and the way he reported news, even on the air. But
it was awesome.
Well, I don't, a lot of people thought that you made a good story, but I don't really think it was. But then another time we had a strange thing. Somebody came by and threw something, a candle or something that was lighted up on the house. And we'd get phone calls. Then in the 60s when I was doing this full time, about Nickelodeon and that kind of thing.
Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah.
And actually I think the children probably got more back than I do, because I was in an environment where I was praised, and you know, everybody thought I was wonderful because I was doing these things.
They were in school
with Druid Hills, and you know, nobody much too keen on what they were doing.
Begin to pull this all together.
Did you see the talk about Atlanta in the American Spectator this week or last week?
No, I didn't see that.
It's something I heard from
on
Atlanta. And the black, well, it started with Andy Young and being the mayor and the campaign, the convention being there. And I don't know who wrote it, but it's very good, I think. A very true picture of what Atlanta feels like today. And of course the sort of disappointing thing, I don't know why, you know, we should expect the blacks to behave better than we did. But again, we have a mirror image, you know, blacks in City Hall give jobs to their friends, just like whites in City Hall give jobs to their friends. Yeah.
Why should anything really
Right. And that's the model, you know. They say that's what we tell them.
How about relations between your organization and the black leadership in Atlanta? Were efforts made to coordinate activities in any way?
Oh, yes. Yes, we had very good relationships. And I think they appreciated what we did. Most of the, like the NAACP people, we worked together. We worked with SCLC and SNCC and all. And
so there was an effort to sort of look at issues that were pertinent at that particular time. So you would both discuss or coordinate activities on desegregation.
Oh, yeah. Well, the NAACP, for example, they had a local group called the Metropolitan Atlanta Summit Leadership Conference. And they drew up an agenda. And with the schools and the police and house, you know, all these things. And we worked with them on that. And I think that was a well-coordinated effort of all the groups in town, the local student group and the ministers and everybody. I think the black community appreciated the efforts of Councilman Jimenez and all that it was, but now I think they realized the limits of our strength, you know.
Right.
Yeah, when you look at the people on the board, from the white and the black communities, they really outranked us in almost every field.
How about the importance of racial factors in decision making in the city? Mayor Jackson in 1975 said that race is the underlying force in the area's politics, no matter what the rhetoric.
I think that's right.
Yeah. Everything, if you think race was the...
Yeah. Yeah. And I think it still is.
That was determined subtly or obvious of all decisions.
Sooner or later. It either was that in fact or appeared to be so that it was taken, you know, that's that. I'm not sure whether this is a good example, but even at Tech, I was amazed to read what's the new president's name?
Oh, Creason.
Yeah. What his goal for Tech was to make it outstanding as a college for women and minorities. And I thought, that's not what it was all about. You know?
Well, I think he just wants to open the doors a little bit.
Yeah, I know, but I think, you know, the whole part was to make it not matter And maybe it's going to take 500 years, and maybe we'll never get to that point.
Too soon for that. People still think, see things in this country as black and white.
There's
no getting away from it.
But I think we did well at what we're trying to do. And I have some friends who think, we didn't really accomplish anything, and I don't think that's true.
No, I think we accomplished a lot.
And
Atlanta certainly was a city that experienced less violence than other cities, so that's an accomplishment. Whoever did that, that's an accomplishment. Do you think there was any great change when Mandy Jackson came into office? Change the way blacks and whites looked at you?
Oh, I think everybody was very proud. We were very proud of ourselves. And I don't, the fact that Mandy's not very black. And he's very middle class.
Oh, not very middle class black in high school.
No, I mean, physically he's not very black. I mean, that, you could accept him and feel comfortable with him, and he comes from an old Atlanta family of, poor educators and all that. And as far as pedigree and training and all that, Nina probably was at the top of the list of anything else we've had in a long time. And so I do think that people took pride in that.
Do you think they were, Atlanta worked a little better because in this city the upper class whites had comfortable blacks to speak to, educated, articulate?
Yes. One of the first things I remember reading or hearing when I really started doing this full time was that Atlanta had several institutions, black institutions, which were unique to Atlanta and which are necessary for any community to survive there. So it's a bank, Citizens Trust, it's a savings and loan. There was a college, several colleges, and the newspapers. So that there could be a dialogue between the two communities.
Oh, yeah, I've heard that from other people.
You're
sitting down and you're with equals.
And I think there was a column by, I think it's a black writer, but one of the general was, who was saying that he didn't understand the complaints about the banks not getting loans to blacks. That, that's what the Citizens Trust has been all these years. And he, for one, was going down to see Citizens Trust was redlining in his community, and so that he'd do something.
Well, because that was limited compared to what the trust company or CNS.
Right, but at least they could stop.
Oh, and they did.
But you see, the Citizens Trust, it's sort of strange. Since they have these black institutions, and the black institutions have a monopoly in the black community. And the Citizens Trust, in many respects, did not act quite much like a bank in the old days. I remember the Council on Human Relations. We had our small bank account with Citizens Trust, and I'm the treasurer of our council was a lady who had come to Atlanta years ago to be treasurer of Spelman College. She was a Rockefeller. And she was dedicated to the welfare of the blacks, but she finally said she thought we just had to change to another bank because Citizens Trust, they never got the statements on time, they weren't accurate, and this and that. And I have noticed there's something when blacks find themselves in certain positions of influence or authority. In many instances, they tend to seem to think that it's a two-dimensional thing. Like if you're directing, you have a big desk and a flag. But what you do as a director is not as apparent.
Well, I guess the achievement is getting someplace, and then you worry about what you have to do.
All the fact that there really is work to be done, is been something that they...
I think it's probably true of a lot of people who have spent so long on the trail to get someplace,
yeah,
and then found out, there I am, now what do I do?
Yes, yeah.
Probably true of a lot of presidents, I'm sure, who have
yes.
spent many years trying to get to be president.
Well,
that's all very interesting. Yeah. Thanks very much.
Well, I'll be interested in what you write.